8. When you spend your entire life in and around the city of Chicago, as it turns out, you fail to fully apprehend certain facets of rural life. Take, for example, the troubling case of the rooster. To Colin's mind, the rooster crowing at dawn was nothing more than a literary and cinematic trope. When an author wanted a character to be awoken at dawn, Colin figured the author just used the literary tradition of the crowing rooster to make it happen. It was, he thought, just like how authors always wrote things in other ways, in ways other than how they actually happened. Authors never included the whole story, they just got to the point. Colin thought the truth should matter as much as the point. He figured that's why he couldn't tell good stories. That morning he learned that roosters really don't start crowing at dawn. They start well before dawn. Around 5 a.m, Colin rolled over in the foreign bed, and for a few slow seconds, as he squinted into the darkness, he felt good. Tired and annoyed with the rooster, but good. He then remembered that she'd dumped him, and he thought of her in her big fluffy bed asleep, not dreaming of him. He rolled over and looked at his cell phone. No missed calls. The rooster crowed again. Cock-a-doodle, don't, motherfucker, Colin mumbled. But the rooster cock-a-doodle did, and by dawn, the crowing created a kind of weird dissonant symphony when mingled with the muffled sounds of a Muslim's morning prayers. Those hours of unsleep-throughable loudness allowed him ample time to wonder about everything, from when Catherine last thought of him to the number of grammatically correct anagrams of rooster. Around 7 a.m, as the rooster, or perhaps there was more than one, perhaps they crowed in shifts, entered its third hour of shrieking cries, Colin stumbled into the bathroom, which also connected to Hassan's bedroom. Hassan was already in the shower. For all its luxury, their bathroom contained no bathtub. Morning, Hass. Hey, Hassan shouted over the water. Dude, Hollis is asleep in the living room, watching the Home Shopping Network. She's got a $1 billion house, and she sleeps on the couch. Bees foofle are weird, Colin said, pulling out his toothbrush mid-sentence. Whatever, Hollis loves me. She thinks I hung the moon, and that you're a genius. And at $500 a week, I'll never have to work again. $500 can last me 5 months at home, dude. I can survive on this summer till I'm, 30. Your lack of ambition is truly remarkable. Hassan's hand reached out from behind the shower and grabbed a towel monogrammed HLW. He emerged moments later and walked into Colin's room, towel around his sizable waist. Listen, Kefir, seriously. Lay off about me going to school. Let me be happy, I'll let you be happy. Giving each other shit is fine, but there comes a point. Sorry, I didn't know the point had come. Colin sat down on the bed, pulling on a Cranial Kids t-shirt he'd been given. Well, you've brought it up 284 consecutive days. Maybe we should have a word, Colin said, for when it's gone too far, just a random word, and then we'll know when to back off. Standing there in his towel, Hassan looked up at the ceiling and finally said, Dingleberries. Dingleberries, Colin agreed, anagramming in his head. Dingleberries was an anagrammatic jackpot. You're anagramming, aren't you, motherfucker? Asked Hassan. Yeah, Colin said. Maybe that's why she dumped you. Always anagramming, never listening. Dingleberries, said Colin. I just wanted to give you a chance to use it. Okay, let's go eat. I'm hungrier than a kid on his third day of fat camp. As they made their way down the hall to a spiral staircase that led to the living room, Colin asked, as close to a whisper as he could muster, So why do you think Hollis wants to give us jobs, really? Hassan stopped on the staircase, and Colin with him. She wants to make me happy. We fatties have a bond, dude. It's like a secret society. We've got all kinds of shit you don't know about. Handshakes, special fat people dances. We got these secret fucking lairs in the centre of the earth, and we all go down there in the middle of the night when all the skinny kids are sleeping and eat cake and fried chicken and shit. Why do you think Hollis is sleeping, Kefir? Because we were up all night in the secret lair injecting butter frosting into our veins. She's giving us jobs because a fatty always trusts another fatty. You're not fat. You're, pudgy. Dude, you just saw my man tits when I got out of the shower. They're not that bad, said Colin. Oh, that's it. You asked for it. Hassan pulled his t-shirt up to his collarbone and Colin glanced over at Hassan's hairy chest, which featured, okay, there's no denying it, minor breasts. An A cup, but still. Hassan smiled with great satisfaction, pulled down his shirt and headed down the stairs. It took an hour for Hollis to get ready, during which time Hassan and Lindsay chatted and watched the Today Show, whilst Colin sat at the far edge of the couch and read one of the books he'd stuffed into his backpack. A Lord Byron anthology, including the poems Lara and Don Juan. He liked it pretty well. When Lindsay interrupted, he'd just come to a line in Lara he liked quite a lot. Eternity bids thee to forget. What you reading there, smarty pants? Asked Lindsay. Colin held up the cover. Don Juan, she said, pronouncing the Juan like Juan. Trying to learn how to avoid getting dumped. Not interesting, Hassan pointed out, but Lindsay seemed to find it more aggravating than not interesting. She rolled her eyes and picked up the breakfast plates from the coffee table. Hollis Wells came downstairs wrapped in what looked like, for all the world, a flowery toga. What we doing? She spoke quickly. Is we're putting together an oral history of Gutshot for future generations. I've been pulling people off the line to do interviews for a couple of weeks, but I ain't got it. But I ain't got it now you're here. Anyway, the downfall of this whole operation so far has been gossip. Everybody chattering about what everyone else says or doesn't say. But y'all don't have a reason in the world to talk about whether or not Ellie Mae liked her husband when she married him in 37. So, it's you two, and Linz, who everybody trusts. I'm very honest, Lindsay explained, cutting off her mum. To a fault, dear, but yes. So you get these people talking and they won't shut up, I assure you. I want 6 hours of new tape turned into me every day, but steer them towards real history, if you can. I'm not doing this for, I'm doing this for my grandkids, not for a gossip fest. Lindsay coughed, mumbled bullshit, and then coughed again. Hollis's eyes grew wide. Lindsay Lee Wells, you put a quarter in the swear jar right this minute. Shit, Lindsay said. Dick. Craptastic. She glided over to the fireplace mantel and placed the dollar bill in a glass mason jar. Don't have any change, Hollis, she said. Colin couldn't help but laugh. Hollis glowered. Well, she said, y'all should head out. 6 hours of tape and be back by supper. Wait, who's going to open up the store? Asked Lindsay. I'll just send Colin out there for a while. I'm supposed to be tape recording strangers, Colin pointed out. The other Colin, Hollis said, Lindsay's. And then she said, boyfriend. He hasn't been showing up at work half the time anyway. Now you'll get. In the hearse, with Hassan driving down the exceedingly long driveway, away from the pink mansion, Lindsay said, Lindsay's Psy boyfriend. It's always Lindsay's Psy boyfriend. Jesus Christ. Anyway, listen, just drop me off at the store. Hassan looked up and spoke to Lindsay through the rearview mirror. No fucking way. That's how horror movies start. We drop you off. Walk into some stranger's house, and 5 minutes later, some psycho's lobbing off my nuts with a machete, while his schizophrenic wife makes Colin do push-ups on the bed of hot coals. You're coming with us. No offence to y'all, but I haven't seen Colin since yesterday. No offence to that fugger, Hassan responded. But Colin is sitting in the passenger seat reading Don Juan. You're dating the other Colin, a.k.a. T.O.C. Colin wasn't reading anymore. He was listening to Hassan defend him. Or at least he thought Hassan was defending him. You could never quite tell with Hassan. I mean, my boy over here is clearly the primary Colin. There is no one like him. Colin, say unique in as many languages as you can. I'm not doing that. Hassan was good at his job, no doubt. Colin felt a rush of affection toward him, and the recitation of the words caused something to wash over the omnipresent hole in his gut. It felt, just for a moment, like medicine. Lindsay smiled at Colin through the rearview mirror. Lord, my cup of Colin's runneth over. She smiled. One to teach me French, one to French me. She laughed at her own joke and then said, Well, okay, I'll go. I wouldn't want to see Colin get his nuts chopped off after all. Either Colin, really. But you gotta take me to the store after. Hassan agreed, and then Lindsay led them down past what she called the Taco Hell to a little side street lined with small single-story houses. They pulled into a driveway. Most people are at home, at work, she explained, but Stans should be home. He greeted them at the door. Stans's lower jaw was missing. He appeared to have a kind of duck bill covered in skin instead of a chin or jaw or teeth. And yet he still tried to smile for Lindsay. Sugar, he said. How are you? I'm always good when I get to see you, Stans, she said, hugging him. His eyes lit up, and then Lindsay introduced him to Colin and Hassan. When the old man noticed Colin staring, Stans explained, Cancer. Now you'll come in and sit. The house smelled like musty old couches and unfinished wood. It smelled, Colin thought, like cobwebs or hazy memories, or it smelled like K-19's basement. And the smell brought him back so viscerally to a time when she loved him, or at least he felt like she did. And that his gut ached anew. He closed his eyes tight for a second and waited for the feeling to pass, but it wouldn't. For Colin, nothing ever passed. The beginning of the end. Catherine, 19, wasn't quite yet the 19 when they hung out alone together for the third time. Although the signs seemed positive, he couldn't bring himself to ask her if she just wanted to date him, and he certainly couldn't just lean in and kiss her. Colin frequently faltered when it came to the step of actual kissing. He had a theory on this subject, actually, entitled the rejection minimization theory. The act of leaning in to kiss someone, or asking to kiss them, is fraught with the possibility of rejection. So the person least likely to get rejected should do the leaning in or the asking. And that person, at least in the high school heterosexual relationships, is definitely the girl. Think about it. Boys, basically, want to kiss girls. Guys want to make out. Always. Hassan aside, there's rarely a time when a boy is thinking, I think I'd rather not kiss a girl today. Maybe if a guy is actually literally on fire, he won't be thinking about hooking up, but that's about it. Whereas girls are very fickle about the business of kissing. Sometimes they want to make out, sometimes they don't. They're an impenetrable fortress of unknowability, really. Ergo, girls should always make the first move, because A, they are, on the whole, less likely to be rejected than guys, and B, that way, girls will never get kissed unless they want to be kissed. Unfortunately for Colin, there is nothing logical about kissing, and so his theory never worked. But because he always waited so incredibly long to kiss a girl, he rarely faced rejection. He called the future Catherine, 19, that Friday after school and asked her out for coffee the next day, and she said yes. It was the same coffee shop where they'd had their first two meetings, perfectly pleasant events, filled with so much sexual tension that he couldn't help but get a little bit turned on just from her casually touching his hand. He would put his hands up on the table, in fact, because he wanted them within her reach. The coffee shop was a few miles from Catherine's house and four buildings down from Colin's. Called Café Selmarie, it served some of the best coffee in Chicago, which didn't matter at all to Colin, because Colin didn't like coffee. He liked the idea of coffee quite a lot, a warm drink that gave you energy and had been for centuries associated with sophisticates and intellectuals. But coffee itself tasted to him like a caffeinated stomach bile. And so he didn't end around on the unfortunate taste by drowning his java in cream, for which Catherine gently teased him that afternoon. It rather goes without saying that Catherine drank her coffee black. Catherines do, generally. They like their coffee like they like their ex-boyfriends. Bitter. Hours later, after four cups of coffee between them, she wanted to show him a movie. It's called The Royal Tenenbaums, she said. It's about a family of prodigies. Colin and Catherine took the Brown Line southeast towards Wrigleyville, and then walked five blocks to her house, a narrow two-story building. Catherine led him down to her basement, floored with wavy linoleum tiles. The damp, dark place featured an old couch, no windows, and very low ceilings. They were 6'3" to Colin's 6'1". It made for a poor living area, but it was an awesome theatre. It was so dark that you could sink into the couch and disappear into the movie. Colin liked the movie pretty well. He laughed a lot, anyway. And he found comfort in a world where all the characters who had been smart children grew up to be really fascinating, unique adults, even if they were all screwed up. When it was over, Catherine and Colin sat in the dark together. The basement was the only genuinely dark place Colin had ever seen in Chicago. Day and night, orange-grey lights seeped through any place with windows. "I just love the soundtrack," Catherine said. "It has such a cool feel." "Yeah," Colin said. "And I like the characters. I even like the horrible dad a little." "Right, me too," Catherine said. He could see her blonde hair and the outline of her face, but little else. His hand, which had been holding hers since about 30 minutes into the movie, was cramped and sweaty, but he didn't want to be the one to pull away. She went on. "I mean, he's selfish, but everyone is selfish." "Right," Colin said. "So is that what it's like? To be a prodigy or whatever?" "Not really. All of the prodigies in that movie were really hot, for instance," he joked. And she laughed and said, "So are all the ones I know." And then he exhaled sharply and looked up at her, and almost, but no. He wasn't sure, and he couldn't handle the thought of rejection. "Plus, in that movie, it's like they're just all born talented. I'm not like that, you know. I mean, I've worked at least 10 hours a day, every day, since I was 3, he said, with no small measure of pride. He did think of it as work, the reading and the practicing of languages and the pronunciation, the recitation of facts, the careful examination of every text lay before him. "So what are you good at exactly, anyway? I mean, I know you're good at everything, but what are you so good at, besides languages?" "I'm good with codes and stuff, and I'm good at, like, linguistic tricks, like anagramming. That's my favourite thing, really. I can anagram anything." He'd never told Catherine about his anagramming. He'd figured it would always bore him. "Anything? Knight nay," he answered quickly, and she laughed and then said, "Catherine Carter." He wanted so much to put his hand around the nape of her neck and pull her into him and taste her mouth, full and soft in the darkness. But not yet. He wasn't sure. His heart pounded. Okay. Her karate cretin. Oh, I like this one. Their arcane trek. She laughed and pulled her hand away and placed it flat against his knee. Her fingers were soft. He could suddenly smell her over the dank basement. She smelled like lilacs, and then he knew that it was almost time. But he didn't dare look at her. Not yet. He just watched the blank TV screen. He wanted to draw out the moment before the moment, because as good as kissing feels, nothing feels as good as the anticipation of it. "How do you do that?" she asked. "Practice, mostly. I've been doing it a long time. I see the letters and I pull out a good word first, like karate or arcane, and then I try and use the remaining letters to make..." "Oh God, this is boring," he said, hoping it wasn't.
"No, it's not.
I just tried to make grammatical sense with the remaining letters. Anyway, it's just a trick." "Okay, so anagrams. That's one. Got any other charming talents?" she asked. And now he felt confident. Finally, Colin turned to her, gathering in his gut the slim measure of courage available to him, and said, "Well, I'm a fair kisser."